success in using online tools to engage students. And we all know, I think, here very own Dr. Dave Brubeck. And we invited Dr. Craig Montgomery, who's going to give a talk after Dave. And I'll introduce his bio after Dave's talk, but I can tell you already that Craig is one of the pioneers of developing and using online tools to teach. So Dave, he is an associate professor in psychology here at Algoma University. He obtained his BA in 88 from Western University, and then his MA from the University of Toronto, and then his PhD in 1993. I know he is his research focuses on intelligence and cognition, and he will be talking about the blog Ate My Homework. So thank you, Dave, for accepting to do this.
Not a problem. That title, by the way, is clever, but it's not my cleverness. This is a title that a friend of mine, John Meadows, who interviewed me on a podcast called On the Log, which I don't think he does anymore, that was the title he used. So I just want to give John credit where it's due. Where did that come from? So before we get going, I just want to say, I know we all know technology. Like, you know, a pencil is technology. Blackboard is technology. So we all know that stuff. And I don't want to get too caught up in that. And I know that all forms of media are social. So let's not get into definitions and that kind of bullshit. And we all know people who use technology, I think, and social media to a distraction. You know, yours truly included, if you ever seen me during a Senate meeting where I'm just posting to Facebook. But I want to talk about how I harness some of these tools that a lot of people use for goodness rather than evil. Why would you want to do this? Well, first of all, Canadians use social media. And I'll give you some stats in a second. Especially younger Canadians, and it seems to me that young Canadians, that's for the most part who, that's who university students are that we're interested in, right? So why not, you know, harness this for ourselves? So I'll give you some idea here, some data. These data actually come from a friend of mine, a social media consultant, Connie Crosby, who I met through podcasting. She's also a law librarian. I don't know, whatever. Just to let you know, there's my disclaimer. This is her disclaimer. Basically, the data come from a lot of different places in a lot of different years. So let's just keep that in mind as I go along, okay? First thing I'll mention is LinkedIn, because a lot of people have it. I know I'm LinkedIn to a lot of you people. The world's largest professional network. I have no idea what it's for. I get recommendations now and then. Oh, Dave knows about research design. Yeah, okay. Then I click, Ken Herndon knows about libraries and the Dewey Decimal System, and we move on. So, I don't know, I thought I'd just bring this up because I think a lot of people have it. 120 million members worldwide. There's about 4 million Canadians. How would we use this in school? I haven't the slightest clue. It's not really that important for me. I have a profile because I try to get a profile of everything. If I can, because then I get the name Dee Brodbeck before my brother Dan gets it. I once actually was trying to get get Wi-Fi in an airport, and it said it was a TELUS hotspot, and I had a TELUS cell phone, so I loaded up, and I said, I'll just log into my, and I hadn't logged in a long time, and it said, what's your mother's maiden name? And I thought, well, I don't actually use real answers to those questions, because you shouldn't. You should use, like, Mustang 57. Don't use that, now everybody knows that. As your, you know, some stupid answer. But I typed in my mom's maiden name, and it said, welcome, Dan. So my brother paid for my internet access at that airport. I then immediately sent him a message saying, Dan, you probably should change your password, because I now have taken over your account, and apparently it's overdue as well. You probably should pay that. Now, Instagram, on the other hand, is something a lot of people use. Instagram is, if you don't know about this, it's basically a photo-sharing service. Let me just move the recorder out of the way here. So it's a photo sharing service. 200 million users worldwide. This was bought by Facebook last year for $1 billion, or as people in the tech community call it, one Instagram. So when they talk now about, you know, how much is a company worth, how many Instagrams is it worth? Because it sold for $1 billion. 70% of users log in per day. Now, I haven't used this yet, but I have some ideas of how to use it. I'm thinking of things like pictures of things I draw on the blackboard. Because people in class may not draw the horrible diagrams I draw. They might do things like that. And sometimes I draw very complicated diagrams of synapses and things like that. So why not take a picture and share it on Instagram? So I haven't done that. I have an Instagram account, which I don't use a whole lot. But that it's a possibility. Now, on the other hand, this is something I do use. There are 645 million Twitter users in the world. And 200 million of those are active users. An active user is defined as someone who logs in once a day. That's a lot of people. There are 200 million messages sent per day. I refuse to use the word tweet. I feel stupid when I say it, so I will not say it. 22% of Canadians are active users of Twitter. That means one in four people are each day using the service. They're logging in. It doesn't necessarily mean they're posting something. But they're logging in, they're reading stuff. In the morning when I get up, I open my Twitter feed and take a look and see what's in the news. That's how I get my news immediately, because I follow people that would have the same interests as me. I look at other stuff as well. So I think we might have something here that might be useful. Right? Because we have a lot of people using this. Of course, the big elephant in the room is Facebook. Now, again, active users logging in once a day, 900 million! And there's about, depending on who you ask, about 1.4 billion people using Facebook. And when it gets into China, that will double. Right? Wow. And it's growing heavily in China and in India. Again, telling you something. There's a lot of people, I don't know if you know this, a lot of people living in those two countries. A lot of humans, a lot of people. So that's people who log in once a month, rather. That's how they're defining it. Now, 700 million, according to Inside Facebook, are active users. That's Facebook tells you it's 900 million. Inside Facebook says 700 million. Who knows? It's a lot of people. But 50% of users do log in on any given day. There are 19 million Canadians using Facebook. In other words, about 55% of Canadians on any given day are using Facebook. So again, it should tell you something. Now, this is one you may not have thought of, which is YouTube. There are 17.6 million active users in Canada of YouTube. Now, that just might mean looking at videos. This might just mean logging in and looking at videos or posting videos of going up and down on an elevator. It's just for me and Isabel, that joke. Our son does that. Go to his channel, John Broadbeck. I can tell you that to use YouTube now, you need a Google Plus account. It's very confusing and bizarre. But that's a lot of people. That's half of us, right? 71% of Canadian internet users versus 53% of U.S. internet users, which is an interesting statistic, and I don't understand why it's like that. The latest data I could get, 2 billion views by Canadians as of November 2010. And here's an interesting statistic. 24 hours of video are uploaded per second. That should tell you something. People are sharing stuff, and it could even be useful. It's not just cat videos. There are cat videos, and that's the internet is for cat videos, and which Game of Thrones character are you quizzes. That's basically what the internet's for. But that's a lot of video. Here's some. This is comparing Google Plus, way down at the bottom. I didn't even mention Google Plus today because I don't understand it and know what it's for, and I think it's a bust. Because I don't understand. There's LinkedIn. You can take a look, though. YouTube and Facebook are the biggies here. If you don't understand these things, these different networks, here's social media explained to you in donuts. So as you can see, Twitter, I'm eating a donut. I like donuts. My favorite one here is LinkedIn. My skills include donut eating. Google Plus, I'm a Google employee who eats donuts. So basically, they all do roughly the same thing. You're sharing information. And that's... Think about this. People, guys, I say guys. I think guys is that's a term. That is what we do. We share information. That's our job. We share things. So I think not paying attention to this is kind of silly. Right? You can sit here and say it's all about cat videos and what Game of Thrones character quizzes are you, but that is not only what it is, because there, if there's half of Canadians every day are using it somehow, unless you think that, well, I'm better than that half. See, I wanted to make you feel silly because you all felt elitist there. That's what I was going for. You know, it's something we ought to look at. It'd be like somebody saying, you know, in the 1400s, printing press is stupid. I like my books to be hand-scribed and illuminated. Right? You can't ignore this. You may not like it. I don't care if you like it. No one cares if you like it. The thing is, it's real. It's a real thing. It's not going anywhere. It's an important piece of information. One of the things that we could also tie this in with is mobile internet use, basically phones. 5.3 billion mobile users worldwide. That's a lot of people. And in fact, in developing countries, most people are getting their internet over mobile networks. They don't have a home broadband connection. They have a smartphone or a feature phone that does things like, for example, can use Facebook, can use Twitter, and very little else.
The big growth, as I said here, is being led by India and China.
In Canada, 26.5 million mobile phone subscribers.
26.5 million,
and there's 34 million people. And how many of those are kids under the age of 10? Everybody has a phone, right? I mean, basically every adult Canadian has a smartphone. It's just the way it is. 10 million people. It's a lot of people. 46% of mobile phone users visit social networking sites every day from mobile devices, and the average for Canadians is 2 hours and 19 minutes a day.
Jeez,
that's a lot. Right? That cuts into video games and drinking heavily, right? Like, that cuts into everything that's fun in your life. Why do I mention mobile use? Well, one of the things that I think we've all seen people text in class. And I'm no fan of it. I tell people, please don't text in my class. Or if you're looking at your crotch and smiling that much, you're either texting or doing something else, and either way, you shouldn't be in my classroom. go do that on your own time. But the point is that people are doing this. They're texting. It used to be that talking was the thing we were all concerned about. And that's not, we see talking in class, now we just see it with people doing with their thumbs.
All right.
So now let's talk about, I want to talk about how we can harness some of this stuff. Now, the big one here obviously is Facebook. So about a billion users, and even if you're not on it, you know people who aren't. Right? You know people who are. And I know that many of you have used it in meetings, because when I post another Senate meeting, I get likes from some of you people. So I know we're sitting in meetings and typing things. And I know you don't let your students probably use it in class very often. And I don't like my students using it in class either. And in fact, I walk around, as you can see, I can't sit still, so I walk around all the time. And if I see somebody's notebooks open, maybe I'll have to close the notebooks again. That's not what you're here for, right? Or if they're watching YouTube videos. I want them to be paying attention to me, or to the content of the class at least. So I will close somebody's notebook. It usually takes once a term I do it, and then no one else does it because it gets around that I'm actually going to do that. Right? So this is one of those cases where you can stop people pretty easily. You say, don't do that. You go by, you shut their notebook. You say, yeah, go. You can go there. Go do that somewhere else. And they don't do it again. And interestingly, then they post on Facebook, Broadbeck's a dick. And they tag me, which is interesting. I like, you know. So, the thing is, there are things we can use this for. It has a lot of great uses. Again, people, part of learning stuff involves people bouncing ideas off of each other. It really does, right? That's an important thing. Class discussions.
I'm not saying this should replace class discussions, but you can use Facebook groups
for giving help about assignments. Yes, I know we have CMS, and it works generally pretty decently. I understand that. Facebook never goes down. I like our CMS system. It works fine. But the user interface on Facebook is a lot easier for me, so I use it. So if I've set something up on CMS, it's also on a Facebook group. I can tell you something. There are the amount of discussion going on in the Facebook group is a lot higher than the CMS. In fact, it's almost infinitely higher because zero, any number is a whole lot more than zero. Right?
So I use it for... I've actually had great success with this.
So I set up a group with the students in the class, and I invite them, and I get to approve them, and it's a private group, and no one else can join or see the content. So it's not like... So you can think of it this way. First of all, it's a pretty safe place. It's not like if someone says something... Let's say they ask a silly question. And I know we all say, there are no stupid questions. But that's a lie, as we all know. That's a way to get people to talk. The idea I always say is, I always figure to myself, there are stupid questions, but I'm not going to make you feel like you don't ever ask them. So let's say someone asks a dumb question in the Facebook group. Do you want that spreading all over the... No, no, no. You don't want that public. You want that to be something within the class. And then someone else... And I don't... Typically, I don't answer those questions. Other people chime in from the class and say, it doesn't really work that way. It works like this. Because they're used to this. And it's a social experience. It's like we're having a tutorial, except they can do it on their own time. And they're doing it with a platform they already know how to use. They do not have to learn how to use this. Right? So it's by invite only, and I'm the moderator, too. And I've never had anybody say anything that was even remotely nasty to anybody. But if I did, I delete it. That's not a problem. I moderate the group. It's my group. So that's not that hard to set up. So, for example, just this most recent, I use this every year for Psych 3256, which is Advanced Univariate Statistics. And I use this every year for that. I post review questions up to the final exam, review exercises. And I don't actually typically answer any questions the students have. I wait until the other students chime in and answer the questions for me. Because, and I think most of us know this, you don't really understand something until you have to teach it. So making them do the teaching in a way, in that case, and I'm just sort of standing there going, yeah, okay, that's right. Yeah, so is this wrong? I said, no, that's actually not quite the way it works. It's more like this. But typically, I don't have to answer anything because the students will be answering the questions for themselves. And I can see on a Facebook group who has seen the posts. In a private group, or any Facebook group, you can actually, there's a little link that says seen by. And the nice thing is, typically, eventually, it says seen by everyone. Which tells me that everyone in the group, and that's almost always been everyone in the whole class, has seen this. Now, if there's somebody that isn't on Facebook or they don't want to join it, that's fine. I email them all the stuff too. They get all the review materials as well. There's no problem there. But I told them, look, if you join this, you're going to be able to interact with all your classmates as well. And typically with students, this isn't a problem because they almost all have Facebook accounts anyway. I mean, the chances of someone not having one is pretty slim. And I told them, you don't have to become friends with me, though I like that because it makes me feel like I have friends. But you need to do that. You just have to ask to join the group, and I'll see your name, and there you are. You're in. Right? Sometimes people have a pseudonym, so I just say, just send me an email telling me who you are, so I can add to the group. But I don't necessarily friend them. If they want to do that to me, they can. That's fine, and I will almost always. If somebody I'm teaching somebody right now, I always accept a friend request because I use this stuff all the time.
So I've had great success with this. Because
it's a way to get the students to do something they're already doing. They're going to have Facebook open when they're studying anyway. I have Facebook open when I'm watching hockey games. Right? It's part of who I am. I'm always on these social networks, so I know they're doing the same thing. I have a 20-year-old daughter. I know she's always got Facebook open. Or she's got it on her phone. And a notification comes up on her phone, And she looks at it and says, Dave Brodbeck has posted something new in Site 3256. And she goes and looks and sees the review material that's there.
Right? And it's interesting seeing how many of the posts actually come from mobile rather than coming from desktop. They're almost always coming from mobile. So students are studying, but they're using their phone to type the messages, which I think is kind of fascinating. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, I'm there partially because my students are there. Partially because I'm a geek and I like to be an early adopter. I've been on it ever since it was available to the public in Canada the first day. It's like, oh, I can do this now. Then Netflix came out, so I never really. Younger people use it for short messages more often than email and more often than text messages. They also use things like Snapchat, which I can't find a use for as far as academically. So I don't
know. Snapchat?
Snapchat. Which is a texting platform where the messages disappear after they've been posted. Not, and there's supposedly a way that you can't screen capture them. It's not really true. But they use it as a way to communicate with each other so they can, they're basic, so they can be surreptitious about things, right? That said, I don't think there's a use for that academically. It might be fun to play with. I don't have a Snapchat account. I don't really want one. I've got enough messaging platforms in my pocket as it is. But they do use Facebook for messaging more than anybody. You don't have to give out your cell phone number. So, like, one of the things I say in the year, I would say, okay, here's my email address, here's my phone number. Don't come by my house. Don't call me at home. I've had that once. Unless you're my honors thesis student, then you get my home phone number. But I did have somebody call me once. It was a little bit weird. But I will say that if you want to give out... You don't want to get text messages on your phone from your students, but if they have you on Facebook, they can send you a quick message. I answer more student questions on Facebook than I do even by email. You have to give out your cell number. Yeah, you don't have to reply either. I'm not at work. I don't have to reply. I do, because it's always open anyway. So why wouldn't I do it? But, I mean, you don't have to. As I said, I use it a lot for these study groups, and I use it also for brain behavior. It's great for that. So it's been quite useful for me. People are afraid of Facebook. Some people, my students will see pictures of my children. Uh-huh. My students will see pictures of me, because they've never seen you before. Many of them, of course, are just our guests that only show up during tests and finals. So they really have never seen you before. That's a real concern, I guess. My students know what happens in my life. And I have two responses to this. The first one is, there are these things called privacy settings. And you can actually walk through them when you join Facebook and learn all about it. And you can post things just to friends. You can have a special group of friends on your friends list that's just your students and only post things to them. And then other things only for family. So you can post all your pictures of you with a beer bong all you want, just to your family. And then other pictures that are of you being all academic, it can be for everybody. Right? I mean, I pretty much live in public, so I don't really care, but that's me. I'm also, I live that way anyway. I don't put anything online or say anything online I wouldn't say to somebody's face. That's my kind of little rule. Then I don't do anything that I wouldn't. Then I won't be embarrassed about anything that I've typed. Right? But your mileage may vary, but there's privacy settings. So you can send things to only certain sets of people. Now, so from Facebook to Twitter. Most people think Twitter's ridiculous. In a lot of respects, it is. There's a signal to noise ratio is pretty low. There's no doubt about that. You have to learn about hashtags, which basically get people in ways so people can search things. Okay? I'll show you this in a sec. And you have to learn about lists. You can curate lists of only certain people. And then you're not watching the whole fire hose of information that's coming in. I follow about 1,000 people, 1,000 accounts. I don't want to see what those 1,000 accounts are doing all the time. But I have different lists that I use. So I'll have a list of people that are gamers, people that are talking about hockey. I have a list of people that are psychologists. I have, and then also the big just fire hose of information that comes in. It's a good general communication tool. You can tell people what you're doing. People say, well, why would I want to tell people what I'm doing? Well, sometimes you want to tell people what you're doing. I'm at this talk at a conference.
I know, I was just at Conference of Comparative Cognition in Florida, and we used our hashtag CO3, and you then say, going to this talk now, going to whatever, whatever. So you'd be able to go, oh, I know my buddy Chris is going to a certain talk. Oh, that's right, that talk's now. I can go with Chris and let's go check that out. Right? So that's pretty useful.
But how would you use it in class?
Well, look, the 140 character habit, that's what texting is. The reason Twitter is 140 characters is because text messages are, have to only be 140 characters. It's just the way it works. Right? So they're already used to doing this, sending short messages. I know people are going to text. I don't like it. And I stop them and I tell them, don't text in class. Or I say, can I see your phone? And I just put it in my pocket. I've done that one. I give it back to them for 4 or 5 minutes. But I know people are going to text. Twitter's a lot like texting. In fact, the interface on your phone is not like texting. Indeed, originally, Twitter was all done through texting. It isn't anymore.
If they have the Twitter app open on their phone, it's more difficult for them to be texting.
So what you're doing is you're competing with something else they'd be doing, and what you do is I get my students to put posts up on Twitter. And when I'm in this classroom with a one or BT, what is it, 205 that has two screens, there's a public Twitter stream up there and there with the hashtag of the class. So it'll be like hashtags PSYC2606. And then here in the middle is the lecture. So someone can ask a question during class if they're the kind of person that doesn't like putting their hand up. And we all have students like that, right? They don't like putting their hand up. They just, that's fine. I don't understand people that don't want to talk. Because I haven't shut up since I was two. But people just don't like putting their hand up. But interestingly, they'll have no problem typing something or texting. So that'll show up on the screen. I also, now if I don't have the two screen, I still have the Twitter app on my phone. And when something comes up, I can see it. And I can say, there's a question here. Or students will come up with interesting links. They'll find something and say, oh, here's a YouTube video of someone with that kind of brain damage. Right? And it's from Johns Hopkins Medical School, and they're showing this. And I go, oh, this is great. Let's take a look at this. And I take a look at the link. Right? So you can see, here's the setup here. So the left screen, and I'm just getting set up for a class that day. On the left screen, there's my lecture getting set up. On the right-hand screen, there's the Twitter stream. But the title, this is from Neuropharmacology. The title of that lecture, by the way, is Weed, Cannabis, and Reefer. With the subtitle, Anyone Want to Get a Pizza? So here's what it looked like. Here's what it looked like this on this day. The students are talking. This is stuff they would say to each other anyway. Now you can see they aren't always the cleverest comments. And in fact, sometimes they're making fun of me. And I have no problem with that because it's all in good fun. But that's one day. If you take a look, I didn't have anything where I used it this term. If you take a look at the hashtag PSYC2606, you can actually see a bunch of discussions where I've had things with students in class. And actually now and then people who aren't in my class jump into the discussion. Notably, Ken Herndon jumps in and makes little jokes, little snide remarks, and I think that's fine because I'm like good friends with Ken. So students are posting questions. They're talking to each other and talking to me. And it's public. So they're not going to say anything too dumb.
So far, this has worked really pretty well for me. If
the class is meaningful for that kind of thing, I haven't used it for a seminar-type class. That would be ridiculous. That the idea there is we're sitting around a table and talking. I'm not going to have people posting. And they don't anyway because they have to be paying attention to each other because it's a discussion in that case. Straight lecture, though, encourages participation because there's people that don't like to put their hands up. There's a lot of people like that. You know, and as much as you can encourage people and get participation grades and all that, it's hard to get some people to do it. They just don't want to put their hands up. So you know, what you do is you set this kind of situation up and they will participate. It's amazing. I have to have two screens going, or I can use my iPad, which I don't tend to use my iPad to do that anymore because I use my iPad to control Chromebook. But I can use my phone. Which involves me doing this a lot.
Because my horrible vision.
But it's nice having it in a class like this because stuff just pops up. And it's been really quite a bit of fun and also been very useful.
Now, Google Plus, I don't get, as I mentioned. I'm still trying to figure this one out. I just post links to it. Interesting neuroscience things. I really don't know why. I'll tell you a little bit more about Google later. Just thought I'd mention that. As a lot of you know, I record my lectures. I'm recording this right now. This will be posted at davebrodbeck.com later today. So I record and podcast my lectures. And I release them for free.
Of course, I'm not going to charge anybody for it. I'm already charging the people that are paying to be there $600 a class. So, not a course, not a class. Yeah, they pay a little premium for me. So I post them as podcasts, which are easily downloadable.
Does it affect attendance? Well, you heard me talk about this before, so I'm not going to go into it for a great deal. I really don't care, which is sort of a joke. I do care. But, as I always say, well, we got your money.
Grades have gone up by an average of 6.8% pre- and post-podcasting. Now, I can tell you that I may be getting better at this, just teaching, though I doubt it. I'm getting older and less enthusiastic, so it's probably the other way around.
If anything, it would balance it out. Plus, I'm more bitter, if that's even possible. The exposure actually has increased to Algoma University worldwide, too, because they're allowed to download by anybody in the world.
I've had 1.8 million downloads of my lectures. Which are not hosted at the university's website, which is like my own personal, because I think it would probably be bad for bandwidth bills, so they're hosted by somebody else. They're far away.
It's actually not that hard. There's lots of resources out there to teach you how to do stuff, to do audio. This recorder I have is actually a pretty good one for a handheld recorder. It's about $200. But if you want to mix things, there's GarageBand for OS X. There's Audacity for OS X, Windows, and Linux. You don't need a lot of gear. And in fact, nowadays, you don't need anything. Most of us are carrying one of these, a phone. And I can open up an app once I put my security code in, called Boss Jock Studio. It's $9. Now, this was $9. And I can mix music into it, and it can then mix it as an MP3 and post it. So there actually are apps available just for podcasting that are in your phone. And I use it sometimes. It drains the hell out of my battery. So I don't use it a lot. But if my recorder runs out of batteries, or I forgot my recorder, which has happened, that I'm scrambling through all the audio equipment in my bag. Oh, right, I got a phone in my pocket, I'll use it. So there's a lot of ways you can do that pretty easily. Where do I put the stuff? Yeah, you need a place to put your files, as I mentioned, Craig. I put all my stuff at archive.org. I don't like things being password protected, so I use archive.org and WordPress site. Squarespace is a nice site. I'm not even paid to say that. It costs money to use Squarespace, but $10 a month. It's cheap and easy to use. It's drag and drop. But I use archive.org, which you can just put your stuff up there. It's easy. I don't want to use the CMS because it's password protected, and I want knowledge to be free. I don't think your degree should be free, but I think your knowledge should be. I think what I know should be free. So I put that out there for anybody to listen to. Right? So that's why I don't put the audio up on the CMS. Also, I would have used up petabytes of hard drives by now.
So the nice thing is, though, on the other hand, you can use them yourself just for background stuff. There's a lot of times, like, we all have this time. We teach enough general level kind of courses where we're not an expert in what we're about to talk about. You're prepping a lecture and you go, oh yeah, that's that one. This stuff where I didn't really understand the textbook as an undergraduate. I now half understand it. I wonder if anyone in the world understands this. I imagine someone must, and they've given a lecture on it, go to iTunes, type it in, and there's somebody from some university somewhere who's doing what I'm doing, and they post their stuff, and you can listen to it. And it's somebody who knows what they're doing, typically. iTunes U, right? It's great tool. So you can just take a look there. And in fact, it's led to me showing up on all kinds of other podcasts too, which is kind of cool. You will find stuff in your areas of expertise or outside it. So you get different areas, different perspectives on the stuff that you do, which is quite cool.
It's great for background reading. I put in quotes there because it's not reading.
It's allowed to reading as much as audiobooks are reading. And audiobooks are reading, people say, I don't know. Still get something out of them. Okay. Let's talk about the social encyclopedia, Wikipedia. The encyclopedia anyone can edit. This is what scares people. Well, if anyone can edit it, it's going to be really inaccurate and bad. Anyone can edit it, and anyone immediately will remove the dumb edits. You'd be amazed at how quickly things get fixed on Wikipedia. A study in Nature in 2005 found there were fewer errors in Wikipedia than there were in the Encyclopedia Britannica. There's also more content on Wikipedia about Call of Duty than there is about World War II. So I'm not saying it's got the downside. That's not actually true. I made that up. But there is... People say, oh, anybody can edit it. Yes, they can. But there are some of us who are active Wikipedia editors. And I have a thing called a watch list. And when an edit comes up that someone types in something stupid, I revert it immediately. Right? In the morning, I check the weather. I check the news. My Twitter stream comes open. And I check my watch list on Wikipedia. And I remove bizarre, stupid things some idiot has said. Right. Or somebody's opinion, because their opinion doesn't matter, right? It's all about sourcing. So anybody can edit it, but there's all these policies and procedures to learn about referencing. You can learn these things, by the way, you have to be patient. My two favorites are neutral point of view, NPOV, which means that things cannot editorialize. They must all be sourced. Right? So if you look at the page about Sault Ste. Marie, it might say, if someone types in, and it sucks... That's not neutral. If, however, someone who has published in a reliable source says Sault Ste. Marie sucks, then I can go in there. And it becomes the consensus opinion of the world that Sault Ste. Marie sucks, then it's in there. So some guy's blog doesn't count, basically. Some woman's posting on Twitter doesn't count. Right? It's what does somebody say in a reliable source? This is, and my favorite ones, because I do a lot of, edit a lot of medical articles, is the medical reliable sourcing, which says it has to be secondary sources, like their review articles, not even primary sources. We don't do OR, original research. We don't synthesize material. We do what the experts have already said. That's what Wikipedia does. And if you look on Wikipedia, look on a talk page, if you look at the top, it'll say talk, you click on that, that's where the discussion's happening about what's going to be in the article.
And you'll often see people, and one of the common refrains that I have is, it doesn't matter what I think or what you think, it matters what experts think. And we rely on them. And even if I'm an expert, it doesn't matter. I edit the page in animal cognition. I am an expert in animal cognition, but I don't say, but this is wrong because I know it's wrong because I know what I'm talking about. No, I have to find something to back that up. So Wikipedia is actually quite useful. So you should read the talk pages. You really get a feel for it if you want to start editing stuff. Because sometimes something comes up, you look at Wikipedia, a lot of us do, and you go, that's just stupid. I know that's wrong, and you want to change it, and it immediately gets reverted. You're changed. You're like, well, why did that happen? And then you find out there's a little comment that says, take it to talk. The talk page is where the debate happens about do we include this or not. You should actually, you should edit Wikipedia. Don't start with your area of expertise. You'll be frustrated at a level that isn't, you couldn't even begin to imagine. Start with something that is an interesting hobby for you. Don't edit your academic expertise. Edit. I started out, the first edits I made were to Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, because I live here. And I made an edit to, what was my first one? After that, it was to the Montreal Canadiens, and then something about P.K. Subban, hockey player. Because it's like, I know about those things, but I'm not an academic expert in it. Eventually, now I edit pages on the causes of autism, animal cognition, things like that, things I actually do know quite a bit about. But I can actually go read an article and understand it, like a review article in those areas. But don't start with your area of expertise. Very big mistake. Pedro, do not start with invasive species. You will be so angry. Because you go, but I know what I'm doing. But the people go, we don't care who you are. And the worst part is somebody with the handle like Crazy Man 511 telling you that. You go, but I'm what? It really is useful. Like I said about this study, the reference sections of Wikipedia are actually good. The stuff that's referenced is amazing. And it's got clickable links, and you can find stuff. I tell my students, you want to write a paper on X, Y, or Z, that's the first place to go. Don't reference Wikipedia. That's not going to help you. Like, I wouldn't like you to reference Encyclopedia Britannica, though, either, would I? I want you to go to primary sources or secondary sources, like review articles. But you can click the links there, and you can get the stuff. All right. So a little bit about tech stuff. Are we in the post-PC age? I think we might be. I'm not sure. There are about 75 million tablets out there, and about 56 million of them are iPads. And those are older data. It's probably more recent, a little bit different than that now. I used to carry articles in my backpack. My backpack was full of articles, just academic papers. I got to read stuff to keep up to date, and if I'm writing something, I need references, right? Oh, I see. 20 or more sometimes, right? Now I have this. And I have an app that I use called Papers. Now, what it does is it allows me to store academic articles on here. And it hooks up to our library, and it hooks up to the proxy server even. And it just works. It's really simple. So I can do a search using Google Scholar. It'll find the article. So this is what it sort of, this is the interface looks like. It'll find the article. Oh, look, it found my PhD thesis. Or it found, oh, look, another article by me. This is self-promotion, clearly. But if Google Scholar finds it, so there's the article. I can now browse through this like I'm reading an article. I can highlight bits, the whole thing. So doing a search there, add PDF to library, and it adds it. So this is only one thing. There are literally, as you know, millions of apps. The app for that, there's the reason for that expression. It's not just that it was a clever advertising thing. It also is true. There's something for everything, even Flappy Bird. Many of the apps are free, and the Papers is expensive. It was $14.99. One-time fee, though, and I get updated all the time. And I am now able to find something very simply.
You changed the fee.
What is it now?
75 euros.
What?
Yes.
Well, I got in early. The rest of you are screwed. 75 euros for the iPad version?
Oh, no.
Yeah, the one on the desktop, yeah, it was always expensive. The tablet one isn't expensive. I don't know what it is still. Anybody got an iPhone they can search or anything? Yeah. Take a look, because I'm curious what it costs now. 75 euros is crazy.
Yeah, 100 and something.
You can pay a guy to carry the articles around behind you. Just have some guy holding articles for you. Hey, go get that. Go find me more articles. And the guy runs off and finds the articles. Here's $100. One-time payment. Google Docs and Google Drive. I have all my grades on G Drive. And I give a link to my TAs. And they put the grades in there. I don't have to email back and forth spreadsheets, which is great. I know one of the things that Brandon has done, Brandon and Pedro, I think you guys wrote this article, right? You involved in this too, right? It was an article that I know Brandon had something to do with it. And you and the students wrote an article on Google Docs, and because with Google Docs you're sharing a document, and it's a word processor, and you can always change back to old versions. So this is actually quite cool. And you can see here's the little chat section here. Oh, hi, Dr. Antunes. See, so there's all the people talking to each other about an article they're writing together, which is great. So why should we use all this stuff? Well, part of the reason is everyone else does, but that may not be the greatest reason ever. We're actually social animals, and I think it's something to take advantage of. This is being social at a distance. People say that we're less social now because of the technology. I don't think that's true. I just think we're being social in a different way. It offers good opportunities for both sides of the podium. So for the students, I think it's important. I think it's also important for us.
I think it's stuff we can use. You're not all going to be comfortable with it right away. You're not all going to want to use everything right away. But it can be very useful and important. I think the more you use it, the more you'll keep up with it, and it'll allow you to do sometimes pretty cool things.
And the nice thing is it's cheap.
Or free. Apparently, except for papers, which is $1,000.
So I just want to, this is a great quote from William Gibson. We live in the future. Most of us just haven't realized it yet.
Which I think is something that if you grasp onto this and harness it, you're going to feel better
connected to the world as well, and connected to your students. And I think that's important. Finally, I just want to thank some people. Thank Isabel, because if it weren't for her, I wouldn't be doing podcasting at all. My son John, who also does a podcast with me. The only person in our family who does no podcast is Maddie. Connie, who gave me the data. Ken and Robin, who I do a podcast with. Anthony Marco and Bob Goyetch. And here's some other podcasts that I do besides my lectures. There's the Best Episode Ever podcast, which is a retro TV show. There's the Marshall McLuhan Variety Hour, which has nothing to do with Marshall McLuhan varieties or ours. We thought a clever name. There's Broken Area, which is on my podcast. And finally, Tangential Convergence. That's the one that I do with Ken
Deposit. And also often fueled with alcohol.
On that note,
I hit the end button,
and I'm done. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Okay.